So I think most of my recent focus over the last several years has been working in Egypt, what is now Tanzania, Madagascar, Antarctica. And historically, there's been relatively little paleontology done in some of these areas. And the groups that I work with, and these are mostly groups from those countries, were really uncovering animals and plants that we wouldn't even have predicted existed 10 or 20 years ago. That's how new these types of data are that we're bringing to the forefront.
Well, that's extraordinary because we've only had one person on recently on the Science Show talking about Madagascar. She's an expert on lemurs, actually, and she's a former vice chancellor of Cambridge, and she's now at Yale. You probably know her.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Well, I think Madagascar captures the attention not only of scientists. Obviously, it's got its natural history, but many people know about Madagascar through popular culture in many ways. But even Madagascar, for as much as we know about it, we're still uncovering new animals, new plants that were alive at the time of dinosaurs. Again, you wouldn't have predicted animals that had these shapes or these inferred behaviors would have even existed.
Are you able to work with the local people as well as the local scientists? Because we've been worried about Madagascar for a long time, the neglect of some of the biodiversity and reduction of forests.
As a paleontologist, I tend to be more focused in with the scientists at the university and the students there, but actually the department that I work with there has a paleo group as well as a modern biodiversity group. So whereas I might not have that direct interaction with people on the environmental side or that interface between humans and wildlife, it's very close to home in the group of scholars that I do work with. That's their home base.
Hmm. And what about protection of the landscape?
It's a question all over the planet, isn't it?
Yeah, but isn't it worse in Madagascar?
Some people might say that. I think those questions really are germane to all of us, whether we're sitting here in the middle of North America or you're sitting in Australia. Certainly it is a topic in Madagascar and other biodiversity hotspots. There's effort that we can put into that all over the planet.
Directly, what research you've been doing in that great island off Africa?
So we work up in the northwestern corner, and there's a packet of sediments, rocks that were laid down around 68 million years ago. So this is not too long before that large last mass extinction. And we are working to understand the animals, the plants, the ecosystems in which those plants and animals existed. Because I think sometimes people focus on things like asteroids and what happens after an asteroid. But really what we need to understand are the dynamics. How does the planet change? And that means how do the animals and plants change in response to large-scale and small-scale environmental perturbances? And so what we're trying to do is get a handle on this part of the planet leading up to that last mass extinction.
You mentioned signs of life, fossils, that you never dreamt existed. Give me some examples.
Well, so in this particular part of the world, again, around 68 million years ago, we have wonderful dinosaurs and a bizarre array of crocodiles. The ones that I focus on myself mostly are birds, and those are not birds like modern birds, but they are birds closely related to modern birds with large toucan-like beaks, but with teeth, as an example, long tails. But we're really understanding the last diversification of birds immediately before modern birds got a hold and took over the planet.
And of course, as we've described before, you have a colleague from the States called Steve in Edinburgh, who's well known, who got the cover story of Scientific American, who's described that very thing and the way in which the birds survived, at least the ones who were like birds of dinosaur heritage, survived after that crash. And they were able to exploit some parts of what was left of forest and then evolve into those amazing things you described as well.
Well, that ties into the work that our group does in Antarctica. So we have it's similar in time, but we're getting a nice signal on what were those very first modern birds, what they look like. Can't tell you about it right now. It's something that's cooking through the review process, but we're gonna have this nice pairing of birds that were dinosaur-like birds, non-modern birds in Madagascar. But if we move a little bit to the south to what is today the Antarctic Peninsula, we are seeing representatives of the modern avian radiation. So they coexisted, temporally speaking, but we're seeing some spatial segregation of the dino-like birds and the bird birds.
I presume Antarctica wasn't necessarily covered with a mile of ice as it is now.
Yeah, indeed that's the case. So Antarctica as we know it is this kind of glacier-covered, ice-covered landmass. That happened much more recently in time than at the time we're studying it. We actually have these beautiful deciduous forests that were located on the Antarctic Peninsula at this time. Again, about 68 million years ago.
Yeah. Because Australia was quite close to it then. Yeah. Moving up something like, I think, 5 centimeters a year at the moment.
Yeah, I was going to say, yes, Antarctica and Australia were partners together at that time. And those still remain probably the continental, the terrestrial environment. Those two land masses at the very end of the age of dinosaurs are still two of the biggest mysteries right now on the planet.
Do explain. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is we do know something about the dinosaurs and other backboned animals that lived in both Antarctica and on Australia. However, right as we approach that end Cretaceous mass extinction, unfortunately, there aren't very good rocks. There weren't depositional systems to bury fossils. So clearly animals and plants were there. It's just the sampling method, if you think about it that way, by having depositional environments that would preserve fossils. Those we don't have, or optimistically, we haven't found them yet.
Isn't it interesting? I broadcast a story involving a paleontologist called Pat Quilty in Tasmania, who actually went down to Antarctica, and he and others have told the story of Captain Scott, who brought back some fossils rather than carrying food and died in the process. And it was those fossils that showed Gondwana existed.
Indeed, that is a good story. And there are other examples similar to that where people doing their scientific survey work, above all else, that's what they are attempting to get back to us.
But in brief, what are you doing in the field here, area around Denver and precincts?
Great question, Robin. So long ago, when I was a graduate student, and then shortly thereafter, I started working with a bunch of colleagues in what is today southern Utah. And it ties in, you might say, wait, what does that have to do with Madagascar or Antarctica? And again, when we think about biodiversity on the planet, particularly in a deep time context, we really need to sample broadly. Yes, we'll have our regional focus, but you have fossils just from Antarctica or just from Madagascar or just from North America. All by themselves, they don't tell you the story of evolution of life on the planet. And so my job here, if you want to think about it that way, or my role here, will be to continue sampling that latest part of the age of dinosaurs here, but it's to really bring it into this broad scale comparison. And that's how science works.
How science works. Patrick O'Connor is the new Director of Earth and Space Sciences at the Magnificent Museum in Denver, Colorado. And he again is putting elements together to gain a greater picture of the past.